rather than just coming up with more points and more detail, it's almost more important how you organize that detail. So
it's like, how was he important, why was something like that?
First, well, that you want to have a structure that's, you know, one argument says the American French Revolutions were important in the creation, a counter argument says they were not important. That's one way of creating a debate, right? And then you'd say, I think it was important because this, this, and this, and this happened. That's just very crudely a way of giving a structure. Then, of course, you can bring in all these very good points. And, of course, the more you can bring in, the better. But still, if it's all over the place and it doesn't have an overall, if it's not in the service of answering that question and assessing competing arguments, then it's going to hurt you. So that's what, yeah. I will come to you guys in a minute. I just want to.
So
yeah,
what you're basically looking for, this is what we were kind of taught in the TSOP, the study of politics, is introduction, arguments, counter arguments, your thinking, and conclusion.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, yes. Number six. Okay.
So there we found three groups of keywords. Sovereignty, number one. Number two, sovereign territorial. And number three, modern society. So we find those three. And then we come to a structure. In one hand, we agree with the question. And secondly, we highlight the limitations by arguing that nowadays we have failed states losing their sovereignties,
uh-huh.
or states not able to protect their own people losing their sovereignties, or state invaded by other states losing their sovereignties,
okay.
and also the rise of the international organization, such as the WTO or the
IMF and World Bank.
And so on.
Okay.
So all these undermine the sovereignty of the states.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the structure is, on the hand, we agree, we explain why, since by arguing with the date 1648
right.
was failure, and explaining that it was the rise of the modern state, and then the second hand we'll highlight the limitations.
And we can reference the
Yeah, I think you're on the right track there by saying first recognizing some merit or saying first you've got to say what that argument is, which is, you know, that in fact there is a link based around the Weberian idea of monopoly of force and everything like that, but then bringing in, as you rightly do, a counter argument maybe about failed states. I wouldn't necessarily talk so much about taking over because there's very little interstate war now going on, but this failed state thing is, I think, a useful, and then assess again, you know, what do you think based on events in the world or whatever. I mean, where you can, the other thing I was going to say actually is where you can bring in theorists, as you say, that are attached to one side of the argument or the other, you want to do that as well, without going too descriptive on any one writer, but just saying, just bringing them in to bolster your own argument in your own words about one side of the argument or the other. And yeah, so I think that's a, you know, broadly speaking, a good way of tackling.
Also, I thought maybe using Kosovo as an example of how sovereignty is sort of under threat from international organizations or outside
powers. Yeah, I mean, Kosovo, boy. I wouldn't get too bogged down in details because obviously any one case might have certain specificities attached to it. So Kosovo, because of international norms around state sovereignty and keeping, you know, former Yugoslavia together, and then, I mean, it's quite a tricky.
Just to say that it is something that can be violated and not managed.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's. I mean, would Kosovo be the best example? Because they kind of broke away from former Yugoslavia. Yeah, Crimea is a good one. Crimea is an excellent example of that. So, or a failed state of some kind, Somalia.
So use like Libya today?
Libya, good, good. Trying to think where else has lost authority. Congo, maybe. Yemen. Yeah, all good examples. All good examples. So that could be, maybe parts of Afghanistan. That's so. I'll just move on to. Are you all one group here, or were there? Okay. Can we have us?
But we did choose six.
Six. Okay. Well. What did you? Did you have something similar? Or I know it's hard to do the same. Okay.
How the EU and the UN have impacts on the sovereignty of a nation, with an effect on the authority over a given territory that a government might have. But saying to a certain extent, the authority of the territory is still under government's control, the military, the police, etc. Generally.
Right. Yeah, no, that's good. And I mean, again, definitions are good, but again, don't get too bogged down in them. And the other thing too is on these points, good, and as long as they're put within a structured framework. So points about the, if you want to talk about global institutions, international institutions, that would be, for example, in the counter argument to the main argument. So you'd have the main argument, then you in the counter argument you bring in all this stuff about globalization or failed state or whatever you want. And then you argue which one makes more sense to you, or is it a mix of the two, or is it maybe one in one, some set of cases, and another in another set of, however you want to answer that in your conclusion. Go ahead.
Can that be linked with capitalism in the modern states, that sovereignty is now being a bit?
Sorry, what was that? What did you say?
Can it be linked in modern societies with capitalism and the multinationals and the corporations having more?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I think that you can bring that in as, again, in that second half where you're questioning that connection. You could say, that multinational corporations, globalization, have weakened the capacity of the state. Did you want to?
Just looking through some of those questions, the first thing that comes to my mind, a lot of them, was things that I've covered in introductions to global politics.
Right. You can bring other things in, but I guess if it's relevant, and this you've really got to be sure that it's relevant to the question that's being asked. And if it is, then great. The risk is you might be talking about something else that's maybe a parallel issue that isn't exactly what this question's about. But I can't say for sure until I know exactly what you've read and. But as long as it's relevant exactly to that question, then yes. The only thing I would say, though, is you want to make sure you cover the core readings and lecture notes. As first bring those out, and then once you've done that, then you can add stuff on top. But if you just bring the stuff from other courses and then you neglect what is in the lecture or in the readings, that will put you at a disadvantage. So that's all I have to. Well, no, if you've covered off what's been taught in the module and you've got some extra stuff, then you'll get extra marks. But it's if you bring in the other stuff, first of all, there's a risk that it might not actually answer the question, or it might answer in a very oblique way. I would say definitely bring it in, but just first make sure you've got the material from the module itself. And then you can bring that other stuff in, but don't bring it in as a substitute. That's all. That's all I mean, really.
Can I just
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. We also did number three.
Number three.
Yeah. And we established that they were both very important. position in terms of forming a centralized government and uprising, I suppose, showing how people can have liberties. The American Revolution, in the sense that it had a more codified structure, there was a constitution formed and two sets of
it's okay.
You know, like, and how it had a written code. So it was important in terms of having it written down. And then we concluded with democracy and how they were both important in terms of spreading democracy all over the world.
Okay. Well, you've got some important points there, and I think that's good in a way. But I don't know fully what you've got down there, but I mean, I can't stress enough the importance of having this idea of a counter-argument.
Mm-hmm.
So even though you're agreeing with that thrust to that statement, you have to at least have looked at the opposite view before you can come to a judgment on which one makes sense. So all I would say is, you know, make sure you do some revision on or try and find some explanations that might say, well, actually, they weren't particularly important, and maybe capitalism or some other development was much more important, and American French.
Anyway.
What's that? It would have happened anyway, and you know, American French revolutions were just for show, you know. So I mean, I'm not saying that's, but you know, there are arguments that suggest that, you know, revolutions. The people who make revolutions are not the people who actually form governments later, and that's a kind of a. Even we can see that in the Arab Spring, so that could be kind of a counter argument that actually. But your tactic of maybe looking at the American and the French, and maybe the argument could be, well, it worked in one case, not in the other. Clearly, France had a much bumpier road to consolidated democracy, and maybe, you know, there are all kinds of arguments about why that is the case. Why was that the case? Well, no, what you would tend to do is you'd say you'd go along with this statement, provide evidence, and the people who argue that, and then you'd go against it by talking about the counter-argument based on authors that would argue that, and then in your conclusion is where you'd bring this in. You'd say, well, in my conclude, actually, that in the U.S. case, yes, in the French case, no. That would be where you'd bring in that nuance. Right. Yeah, and so then that would be another way. That would be a counter argument, I suppose, to this thing. You'd say, well, actually. Okay. Who have I missed so far? Over there. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And we just thought that the way that we could do the introduction is to first define a secular society and what it means to be one. Then talk about two secular societies in particular. We were thinking about France and Italy, we didn't see the need to talk about a non-secular society because it is only asking for us to explain the factors regarding secular ones and then just evaluate that. So we'll go into that, and then also something in the introduction regarding why secular societies came about, or what was the reason for them becoming secular, when they used to, there was a time when things weren't like that. And then the first point would be, we were going to talk about sociological factors, so secular societies, we failed to develop this.
Right.
For the continuing presence of religion and secular society and how effective they were. So, okay, so
Can you just remind me of the question? What was it again?
What are the main factors that explain the continuing presence of religion in secular society?
Right. Okay, so you can... See, the one thing I would say is that if you take your revision, let's say, based on the lecture notes and the lecture, it's almost always going to be the case that you should be able to adapt it in some way to answering the question. And if you should always try to have some kind of a, not for and against, but argument or competing theories. So in this case, you could say, well, one theory is that there really isn't a continued presence of religion in secular societies. You know, you could bring that, even though the question talks about the fact that there is a continuation. I mean, you can always sort of say, well, actually, there's a school of thought that says there really isn't. That's one thing you could do. The other way of doing it might be to say, well, on that question, that it could be competing theories. So one argument could be that... Well, I'm just thinking about it now. One argument could be that there is political, that there is political secularization, but there is some sort of return of religion or presence of religion sociologically. So in the U.S. you have this political secularism, separation of church and state, but you have the social presence of religion because of the strength of the evangelicals and so on and so forth. So that's one way of doing it. Or you could flip it around and say, well, Britain sociologically very secular, but you've got faith schools and bishops in the House of Lords and all of these sorts of symbolic things. So in that sense, there's a, you know, you would want to, but either way, you'd want to make sure you had some kind of a debate. So you might say, well, one school of thought says, actually, it's a pretty secular picture. And others, you can still bring in that debate and say another school says, "Well, there is a presence of religion." So you always want to have some sort of a debate going on. And what I would say is, your revision of the lecture notes and of the course readings, you should be able to adapt those canned essays, if you like. You should be able to adapt them. I don't say you should just spit them out on paper. But what I should say is, you should be able to use, roughly speaking, similar kinds of debates and introduce them into these questions, even if it's not immediately obvious how that would happen. I would read the question and see if you can't fit in that kind of a debate into the question. So I don't know if I... was there another group? Go ahead.
Question 8, section B.
Okay. Question 8, yeah. And by the way, the exam won't have a section A, B, so you don't necessarily have to worry about that. But go ahead, go number 8. Okay. Well, look, I think there's some good ideas there. I think what you like with the others, in this case, yes, definition is important because we need to understand that, you know, the difference between liberalism and democratization. But again, you really want to try to work on having a simple structure here. So one way of doing that is to say, here's the argument that says democratization is the most important. Here's the counter-argument that says liberalization is the most important. And now, then you can bring in all the stuff that you mentioned and say, well, you know, maybe it's a mix, maybe it's some places it was more important. Or maybe it's just liberalization's more important. I mean, that's the, a lot of it'll depend on how you define the terms, but I'd say, again, you really want to have that simple structure you can hang an answer on. If you don't have a structure, you can get bogged down into details and maybe, you know, and you might throw a lot of points in there, but it might not look like an argument, and it might not look like a critical debate. So you really want to kind of try and contrast, you know, democratization important, liberalization important. You've weighed those up, and you've decided which one you think is more important. I know it sounds very simple, but it's worth doing it that way in an exam, I would say, yeah. Yeah, so you'd put in the introduction is where you'd give a very short statement and say, well, you know, here's the definition, and I'm going to first lay out the arguments for why democratization is more important, then I'm going to lay out the arguments why liberalization, then I'll come to a conclusion. Then you just, first section, democratization, second section, liberalization, more important. Then in your conclusion, you're answering the question you posed in the introduction, which is more important. And that's where you bring in all the case study stuff and the historical evidence. And so, whereas in the main, where you're laying out the arguments is more where you're mentioning authors. Or if you're going to mention particular schools of thought, that's where you do it. And then it's in the conclusion where you're bringing in, you know, more contemporary evidence or historical evidence to back up your position. That's... Right.
Are you plagiarizing by not doing that?
No, there's no plagiarism on an exam. There's cheating, but that would involve cheat sheets. But have I missed anybody? Or yeah, go ahead.
So if you wanted to provide evidence, then if you've made an argument and you've made a counterpoint,
right.
Are you saying that you wouldn't need to necessarily use case studies for your arguments, that your real evidence for your arguments are going to be schools of thought and what other authors?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not that you can't throw in the odd example, but again, when you're laying out the arguments, you're not really making an argument yourself. So you don't need to necessarily marshal this case study evidence. I would leave it till the third part where you're trying to evaluate competing arguments, then bring in, you know, case study stuff. So that's proof that, you know, liberalization is more important or whatever. That's where you're offering evidence. For your contention, yeah.
You can make it your own argument, or you can use another author to back your argument. If he sees arguments in the same line as your argument, you can do that?
You could, like, so let's just say you weighed up, you know, Marx versus Weber or whatever, and you really think Weber's got it right, say so, but just to say, I think Weber's right, is a bit weaker than saying, I think Weber's right because... You know, look at Afghanistan and this and that exemplifies his model of bureaucratization, whatever. So providing evidence and is much better than just asserting, because the question is always, well, why is he right? And there you need to be able to sort of, you could say, well, I think he's right because in the case of Switzerland in 1868, blah, 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 that Weber mentions this and this happened. So I suppose you can draw examples from within the writings of particular authors, but it's always useful to bring in some other evidence just to back that up, is what I'd say.
Can you use material outside the lecture notes, and if yes, how much can help by the exam?
I mean, I would probably advise against using too much stuff from outside the readings and lecture notes. Only if it's very, very relevant. I guess it's because having marked many exams over quite a few years, I've seen a lot of people go wrong by bringing in stuff from elsewhere that just didn't really fit. Because you have to think that when we're devising these questions, we're largely thinking about the lectures and readings that we've set out rather than somebody else's course. That's not to say that it can be relevant, but I wouldn't spend too much time on it. I'd really focus on the core stuff that, yeah.
So then would you say that we don't need any outside material for revision other than what we already have from the lectures and the material that we have reading?
I would say probably that's right. I mean, it's the outside stuff could help you, but I've just seen too many instances where it's led people down the wrong path. If you really are confident that it's going to add another nuance, another wrinkle to your, or another level of complexity, then great. But I would caution against doing too much of that off-piste stuff. That's all. Okay. Yeah.
I had a question about the structure. Earlier you said, presumably for each of these questions, you would have three main points in the body of your essay. So you'd have obviously your introduction, conclusion, and the middle, you'd have three. So for each of those three points, would you have your initial argument, your counter argument, and why the counter argument is wrong, and why you're right, from each of those three points?
Well, it's not. You typically are going to have an introduction, argument, counter argument, and then the conclusion, which is where you bring your evidence in. So there you've got one extra section. Now, you could have three competing arguments, you know, economic, cultural, political. I mean, you could weigh any number of competing arguments. I'm sort of saying that there's, you know, a simple way of doing it is having two, and I think in an exam situation, but you might have three in an exam situation. You have to use your judgment. I'd say generally, you know, often there's two, but if you want to try and, if you want to handle three, that can, and you can pull it off, great. As long as you're aware that there's time limits to the exam. Okay. Are there any other questions before we wind up? I know we've gone a little over, but I can answer.
One other question.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff that you said about the criteria with regard to getting the higher grade was, I think it was independent thought.
Right.
Can you expand a little bit on what that means?
Yeah, so this is the question that if you really are going towards a first or a very good first, I will say actually that you know, if you do a solid example question where you've really nailed what the competing arguments are, you explain them well, you might bring in some authors there, and then you do a good job of backing up your arguments, you will probably get a first. You don't necessarily have to be blindingly original. If you can bring in something that's original, it's hard to explain how one would do that. I mean, I suppose it's showing a very nuanced understanding. I mean, if you were able to show, for example, that you understood the difference between primordialism and ethno-symbolism within nationalism theory, and how one was based on evolutionary psychology and the other was based on culture and history, and how, you know, how actually there are nuances between instrumentalism and modernism. I mean, just breaking things down very finely and actually understanding very fine gradations, I mean, that would be very original. I wouldn't, again, in an exam, it's tough to be that original in an exam because it's such a quick thing. You don't have space to really get into a lot of those nuances. So I think that, you know, generally the first class exam answer is just a very well-structured, complete answer that answers the question and doesn't miss anything out. And that's really what you're aiming to do in an exam. Different in a dissertation, different in a, to some extent, even in an essay, you can be a bit more original. But in an exam, you just got to get the core arguments out there and do it in as structured a way as you can.
No, first of all, you have to be lucky to have a study, something that is in the paper. Let's begin from that.
Well, yeah, but... Yeah, but don't forget we've got 19 sessions and 13 of them are covered, so actually a lot of it is covered. So we're not asking you to study 19 sessions. So you actually only you can focus it down quite a bit. So, you know, we're only asking you to maybe study four or five things, you know, maybe six, but at the outside, but probably four or five. So that's quite a manageable, it's not huge.
This one is from 2006.
Yeah, it is 2006. Sorry about that. I will be kind of, I think I put 2005 there and I'm going to have to change that. But please look to 2006. I will change the link anyway, but if you check in the next day, then you might still find the old link.
So it's 2006.
Yeah, 2006. I will change that in the, probably tomorrow. I'll change
that. Also, because these ones relate to you.
Yeah.
This section
is all my part of the course.